Thank you. Thank you, Stefano. And thank you to the organizers for having me here. Well, the history of anatomical representation has focused specifically on the visual representation of the bodies of adult men and women. For different reasons, we do not pay that much attention to the visual representation of the internal organs, perhaps because we are still a long way from considering the beauty of a liver or the symmetry of the urinary system. At the very most, it started with the work and consideration of the American historian Thomas Laher on the model of the one single sex. There has been no shortage of efforts to see correspondences between the male and the female reproductive apparatuses, so that more or less everyone has seen an image of a Renaissance uterus, or as we saw this morning, a Baroque testicle. Although most illustration in anatomy treatises essentially consider the body in parts, divided, section, or in a word, anatomized, the idea of a cultural history of the whole body continues to prevail, a vision that it shares with the history of art. It is not for nothing that both art and anatomy were originally disciplines of the trained eye. Both were designed not so much to represent what is seen, but to see well what has to be represented, to discriminate the vein from the artery or the nerve from the gland. My recent preoccupations in these venues have led me to the frontiers of the body. First, the armpit, the axilla, on which I have written a short text, and now the teeth, on which I hope to write a monograph. In both cases, there are doubly liminal and neglected phenomena, oscillating between what can be considered both exterior and interior, and more particularly between what we consider public and what we think of as private. In both cases, history is compromised when it comes to clarifying the multiple connections in these transit zones, whether textures, colors, smells, or remains. Of course, the mouth, the inside of the mouth, is both a partly private and partly public sphere or space. Its representation and its uses, of which I can only say a few things today, put us in the position of having to accept a vision that is much more closer to the true anatomist. It is a question on these new times of first taking apart, then putting together, or seeking the relationship between the parts so that we can trace their uses, their skills, their prejudices, their myths, their mythologies, their illnesses and remedies, their eccentricities and their symbols. After all, to study a part of the body, whatever it is, means to enter, in my view, into more than one form of knowledge. In this case, anatomy, of course, dentistry and dental surgery will be present, but also religion or magic, economics or art, anthropology, phonetics, psychology, sexology, nutrition, and specifically and especially today, forensic anatomy. The confluence of disciplinary fields should also be added to the various normative structures that have gravitated around the history of teeth. As the wise brush of the French inner painter Louis-Leopold Bailly shows, life passes between the first and the last tooth. In the same way, our history, that of humankind, that of humanity, also passes between the mark that Adam left on the apple of paradise, the similar mark on an apple that many of us carry on our computers. I have to warn you that the history of teeth refers not only to their structure, but also to their function, whether physiological, commercial, or symbolic. There is no doubt that a thousand things can be done with teeth. Collect them, pull them, pull them out, put them in, take them out, clean them, make them dirty, straighten them, replace them, whiten or dark them, sharp them, break them, or describe them. The history of teeth encompasses a wide variety of attitudes and practices, including those that are the subject of ethnography, anthropology, or art. In the culture of teeth, universal knowledge, local norms, and forms of representation are intermingled. But what for many is no more than a semi-hidden part of the body, for others has a meaning that needs to be revealed and clarified. Whether it is the teeth of childhood or old age, their presence, their absence, their trafficking, or their care. As individual objects, teeth have traveled as religious and secular relics, mainly from West. I'm always getting confused with my own papers. Okay. Well, this is the collection of Peter the First, and I should have mentioned that and included that image before. Anyway, as individual objects, human teeth have trouble as religious and secular relics, like in this case, for example, the teeth that the Tsar Peter the First collected when he pulled out some of his friends and enemies, mainly from the East to the West. The cultural significance has also been visually explored. Knowledge of human teeth was present in early ethnographic and anthropological questions. The physical descriptions and measurements form part of early treatises on human diversity. Discussions about the true color, the correct arrangement, and the hardness had been with us at least since the beginning of the 16th century, just as the identification of individuals by the dental signature has been gaining ground in forensic medicine, or even before. Caio Catulus, a Roman lyric poet of the first century, wrote an epigram against Ignatius, who apparently had very beautiful teeth, in the following terms: "You are not a Roman, nor a Sabine, nor an Etrurian, nor a citizen of some place in Italy where you rinse our mouths with pure water. You are a Celtiberian. You are from the country where the inhabitants every morning rinse the tartar from the reddish teeth with the liquid that everyone urinates. The whiter your teeth are, the more they betray the disgusting recipe you leave every night on your night glass." It must have been a very good recipe, because it was still in 4 centuries later, in 1530, that the famous philosopher Erasmus of Rotterdam claimed to rub his teeth with salt to avoid precisely the custom of cleaning them with urine. Still in 1679, in his Dissertation sur les dents, the French doctor Barthélemy Martin recommended urine to combat caries. Like any other modern relic, teeth have a material history linked to a process of fetishization that flourishes in the context of modern Europe. From reliquaries to wax models, we find preserved human teeth in anatomical figures resting in European churches, monasteries, and chapels. When he died in 1270 at the age of 55, San Luis Jo, the one that you have there, had only one single tooth that later was removed. The inventory of the Notre Dame Cathedral of that particular relic described it in the following way: "Messier San Luis, roi de France, tout entière défaillant à l'exception d'un dent." Although they are placed in the human jaw, teeth also have a little life of their own. As individual objects, their history falls into many different categories and involves a great diversity of domestic accidents, from tooth decay to severe poverty. The same applies to the jaw, the same that we have in the case of the relic of San Luis, applies to the jaw of Santa Polonia, patroness of dentistry. Though her jaw contains no tooth, that doesn't mean that her teeth had played no role in the religious and political configuration of the West. Only in Spain, for example, the King Philip II, an avid collector of relics, was able to gather more than 200 teeth coming from her mouth. When it comes to the history of teeth, many of us may have in mind the drawings of Leonardo or the equally famous treatise on the natural history of human teeth. Well, this is just another example, the Santa Maria della Vittoria in Roma, where they have these teeth underneath the wax model. So they have the Natural History of the Human Teeth by John Hunter, but some of the most intriguing representations of teeth come, in my view, from the realm of art. If we look at contemporary art, the examples are numerous. I'm referring, for example, here, well, this is still John Hunter, this is Gamelin. There are plenty of representations of teeth in anatomical treatises. I'm referring here, for example, to Carlos Castro, The Cup with Teeth, or from the same artist, 300 Teeth. of which he says, in 300 teeth, you will find the story of 3,000 or 300 mouths. The story of 300 different people, a social structure, a shared community. In the case of the Lichuan artist, George Makinas, we find the iterative story of dental exploration very much in the same way that we can find it in clinical photographs of not so long ago. During the surgical revolution of the 18th century, there are plenty of representations of issues related to the loss and replacement of teeth, while the representation of the dentatore is massive in the early modern period, and I'm just going to give you a few examples of that. And it is usually represented as a sort of a static figure, but dozens of images that very likely you've seen very often here and there, and which makes a very nice comparison with some others from the 19th century, with the idea of if we could replace dentatore by the machine, then tooth extraction would be painless. But in any case, the traffic and the stealing of teeth was a matter of concern for both the English caricaturist Thomas Rowlandson and for the Spanish painter Francisco de Goya. Again, just to give you some examples, I mean, this is Thomas Rowlandson, where they are stealing or getting teeth from the poor to put into the mouths of the rich. And this is a very famous drawing, an extraordinary image of a woman stealing teeth from a cavalry. The history of teeth, therefore, cannot be written without considering three different things: the mass production of dental prostheses, of which I will say nothing, the development of orthodontics, of which I say also nothing, and finally, the uses of teeth in forensic medicine, of which I'm going to say a little bit. Research from mitochondrial DNA extracted from the pulp of tooth has become, as you all know, a key element in the context of medical, legal dentistry, as well as in archaeology. One of the most interesting examples in this respect was the identification of the remains of Copernicus from archaeological exploration in Fombroke Cathedral. They discovered the remains of 13 corpses. By comparing the dental material with the DNA from a hair found in an edition of the Calendarium Romanum Magnum used by Copernicus, which was taken to Sweden during the Swedish-Polish wars of the 17th century, it was possible to identify the remains of the famous astronomer. Less well known was than the representation between teeth and pain, and also less well known that the uses of forensic dentistry based on the examination of human teeth is the connection between teeth and love, and then the identification of individuals on the ground of their teeth marks. In what remains of this presentation, I would like to say a few words about both things. On the one hand, I want to give you only few indications of the superbiological cultural dimensions of mastication. On the other, I will say a few things about the transcultural and transhistorical dimension of biting. In both cases, the history of teeth is, in my view, related to the elusive history of gestures. Over the centuries, and this is an essential part of my research, over the centuries, human beings have put the most extraordinary things in their mouths. One of the most famous of those would be the bucaro, those little pieces of jars, these little jars made of clay, eaten by the Spanish nobility in the 17th century with the intention of whitening their skins. But the list can be easily extended. In the 19th century, it became quite common, for example, to eat paper. Pica, the disorder that consists in chewing or swallowing objects that have no nutritional function, has been extensively studied by modern psychiatry, but also by other clinical specialties such as stomatology, dermatology, or epidemiology. Morsicatio bucarum, the repetitive action of biting the tongue or the inside of the cheeks, is now considered an obsessive compulsive disorder, which, however, does not require treatment in its more moderated cases. Likewise, neither does the desire, realize or not, to bite others whom we love or hate. Let me just give you some examples in the history of painting of human beings eating, for example, their nails. eating the pen, which is something that, well, it has become mainly the 20th century quite an activity. In fact, there is a sort of a humorous newspaper in Spain called El Mundo Today, in which they produce this sort of a joke saying, well, now the big is going to produce already beaten and sad taps so that you don't have to do it anymore. Well, not so much of a joke, because in fact, the cup of the big is now has a hole, because there were many people who actually swallow it with this big risk for their health. This is one of the gestures that I'm studying now. It is the gesture in which people actually bite their lower lip with two different indications. And it is either sexual desire, or it is the idea of doubt and skepticism. I have a big collection of those. Not so easily. I mean, in the 20th century, which is very much a visual culture, these are very easily well found, but not so much in previous times. I was talking about the desire realized or not to bite others whom we love or hate. Among the latter, the most bloody case, never better said, of a homicidal bite, of which I have, of which I know anything about, was the one which, according to some versions of the Bible, Cain inflicted on his brother Abel. This is depicted in at least in one bas-relief in the choir of the Toledo Cathedral that has generated no little debate among our historians, specialists. This is the image of Cain killing Abel by biting. Halfway between love and hate, it is the epidemic of biting nuns that broke out at the end of the 15th century that deserves a sort of explanation. The story is told by Zimmermann in his book on solitude. All the epidemics of female which I myself have seen in Germany, or of which the history is known to me, the most remarkable, he writes, is the celebrated convent epidemic of the 15th century. A nun in a German convent fell inclined to biting all her companions. In the course of a short time, all the nuns in this convent began biting each other. The news of this infatuation soon spread, as passed from convent to convent throughout a great part of Germany and Holland. Finally, the epidemics actually reached Rome. The childish mania, but not only childish, of biting the lip or the nails may become a clinical problem in the same way that is of what is now today called a hyches. The anthropological study of this type of sucking, technically known as erotic ecchymosis, is surprisingly carried out by many. The study was carried out by one of the greatest British sexologists and psychiatrists, Havelock Ellis, who devoted an entire chapter to it in the context of the third volume of The Psychology of Sexual Life, published in 1990. Though Ellis' discussion was, as I'm going to say in a second, mainly based on British sources, the inappropriate use of teeth with the intention of biting lovers are documented in many other different authors. The list includes many Roman classics, such as Plautus, the aforementioned Catullus, Propertius, Horace, Petronius, and of course Ovid. Plutarch, for example, describes how Pompey's lover Flora could never say goodbye to his lover without first biting him. In the Perfumed Garden, the 15th century Arabic religious manual, there are also many other references regarding, for example, the caresses and gestures that men should give their partners to facilitate coitus. This fascinating book recommended bitings in the arms. In the Indian Kama Sutra, a whole chapter is also devoted to it. In chapter 5 of this erotic religious treatise composed sometime between the 3rd and the 6th century, its author, Vatsyayana, begins by describing the kinds of bites that lovers can give to each other. In his opinion, all places can be kissed and bitten, with the exception of the upper lip, the inside of the mouth, and the eyes. From there, Vatsyayana begins with a great disquisition that starts by explaining the form that a proper denture should have and the different marks that such a denture can inscribe onto the body. The kinds of bites are the hidden bite, the two midnight, the dotted line, the coral and jewel, the jewel line, the broken cloud, and the boar's bite. Between the first, the hidden bite, which is only potentially noticeable by the reddening of the skin, and the last, the boar bite, which consists of several thick rows of marks close to each other and with red intervals, which is also imprinted on the breast and shoulders, there is a whole categorization of the way of biting a human being. Back to Europe, the habit of biting and being bitten seems to Ellis to be so widespread that its origins in its moderate form can be compared, in his view, to kissing, as in the case, in his opinion, with many other mammals. In its most extreme manifestations, I quote, it tends to become one of the most violent and antisocial of sexual aberrations. Thus, for example, one of Ellis' correspondents describes his mistress' habits in this way. She is particularly anxious to eat me alive, and nothing gives her greater satisfaction than to tear open my clothes and fasten her teeth into my flesh until I yell for mercy. It is unnecessary, Ellis writes, to accumulate evidence of a tendency that is as common as well known. Practiced apparently profusely in the northern countries, it inspired the poet Heinrich Heine to explain in the romance known as the Battlefield of Hastings, how the protagonist, Edwin Schwanek, was able to recognize the horrified and the horribly mutilated body of her husband, Haroldo, not by his teeth, like in the case of the King of France I was referring to, but by the mark that her teeth had left on his lover's skin. Still in the 20th century, there were few judicial cases in which forensic dentists were called to identify criminals based on the mark that their teeth have left on the body of the victims. As far as I know, teeth marks of perpetrators no longer count as judicial evidence. There are, however, very interesting criminal cases in which conviction was based precisely on those marks. More in general, I would like to suggest by finishing this talk that the history of anatomy is not simply the history of a descriptive disciplinary field and its metaphors, but the history of an object with its variations, symbolisms, and mythologies. To pay tribute to Jan Hacking, the philosopher of science, the philosopher and history of science, who just passed away recently, we could describe our endeavors as a historical ontology of the body, as the counterpart of a historical epistemology of knowledge. This historical ontology of human teeth will have to explain its moments of salience and disappearance, the historical modulations and the culturally determined values, but it would also have to pay attention, in my view, to those cross-cultural and trans-historical similarities that allow us to talk about an anthropological basis of experience. As it happens, what we all humans share is not a biological, if not a biological fact, but as a cultural species belongs to the categories of what Michel Foucault would have called the truths of the irrelevant. Maybe some of the gestures that I have just described are part, like bitings one leaps or bitings where lovers are part of the irrelevant. Maybe they are, or maybe not. Thank you so much for your attention.